Look, whether or not Anton is indeed a midget or a dwarf...
No, he's a midget.
What's the difference?
Well, a dwarf is someone who has disproportionately short arms and legs.
Oh, I know the ones.
Yeah, it's caused by a hormone deficiency.
Yeah, bloody hormones. Yeah. Mm.
A midget is still a dwarf, but their arms and legs are in proportion.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
So, what's an elf?
Do you want to answer that?
An elf is a supernatural being. Sometimes they're invisible, they're like fairies.
They don't actually exist, do they? In real life.
Now, I was looking at some of these notes I have on the book and stuff, and one of the things you talk about in there is the phantom roar.
This basically was to do with a couple that moved into a property in London only a couple of years ago. And they would start hearing a roaring in the corridor as if there was a lion in there. And they would be feeding their domestic cats and they would get a roar. Maybe they believed that the house had been built on some type of place where there might have been an ancient menagerie or something. But I'm quite familiar as well with these roars in the sky. The book I've done, The Shadows in the Sky, it actually does mention phantom hums, roars, bangs, explosions and that sort of thing as well, because we've got a lot of stuff in the UK regarding these irritable hums which drive people absolutely mad, but only certain people can hear them. And it's actually resulted in some people even dying, and lots of weird stuff going on. But whether it's come some type of supersonic craft that we don't know about, I think that could be the case in the sense of some of these bizarre roars.
Yeah, it seems that way. You're like underground drilling or something, I've heard people theorize.
Yeah.
So, all right, yeah, I wasn't sure.
But it is odd that sort of stuff's going on, though, because you start thinking, well, this is affecting people. Nobody, the so-called government or the authorities, don't seem to care about it. So why aren't they investigating it? I've got a case in The Shadows in the Sky book about a family or an old couple that moved to a retirement home in the wilds of in Kent, in a rural place, and started hearing these bizarre humming noises that was constant. Nobody else could hear it. They would send out sort of inspectors and nothing would happen. They would make inquiries and nothing would be sort of followed up, and eventually it drove them mad to the extent that the lady died because she was so ill because of the stress. The guy said his teeth and his hair fell out, and they eventually moved away. And they'd actually, this was bizarrely near Ministry of Defence land. So once again, it makes you wonder what's going on, and it's quite creepy once again. I'm not really a big conspiracy theorist, but you do start thinking, well, is this our own government or military doing this? And they obviously don't care about those that they're affecting.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting, too, because we get into, we're talking about these things being potential creations of the mind, and as science advances, maybe, you know, I've kind of talked about this with other guests, too, but almost in the interdimensional sense, but it can apply here sort of with the Tulpa idea, too, that it could be only a matter of time before one day we pick up the newspaper and hear a story that, you know, that they've figured out what part of the mind conjures this kind of stuff.
Yeah, maybe one day. But I think because we know so little about the mind, it's good to have science, but obviously sometimes science is a hindrance, especially when looking for so-called strange creatures to an extent. But I think, I don't know, sometimes you get so confused by all this, you don't know who to trust, and then you start becoming paranoid. You can end up like one of these UFO researchers in the 1950s who starts getting harassed by people that aren't there. They make great stories, but you wonder again if you're kind of feeding this sort of stuff, because you're thinking, you know, do we trust our government? Do we trust scientists? You know, is there weird stuff going on with the military? Are all UFOs part of the government? And you do think to yourself, well, if it's not, then what's really going on? Are there things, you know, coming, you know, from different sort of places? Are they coming within? And the more you think about it, you think you just eventually drive yourself insane. But it's mystery, so you need to investigate it at some point.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Well, have you, you know, like I was saying when we started the interview here, like not to get too meta on the conversation, but it's like I hasten to call you a cryptozoologist. Have you sort of run into friction with the cryptozoology community for your take on some of this stuff?
Not really. Again, what you've got to find is there aren't actually that many cryptozoologists. A cryptozoologist, to me, is a zoologist that pretty much, as a side, will also study strange creatures. Certainly people like, you know, Lauren Coleman in the United States, I'd consider him a cryptozoologist.
Right.
Cole Shuka in the UK, he's had a lot of stuff published. He did the foreword to my monster book, and he's very much of a zoological mindset, but he also does investigate folkloric stuff, because a lot of this stuff does come from folklore, whether it's true or not. But I think as well, you do get, I found it a few times, in certainly in the United States, regarding Bigfoot. I know Nick Redfern did a little blog at some point saying about, you know, Bigfoot is probably not real, it's got to be paranormal. And he did get a lot of, harassment with that. And he wasn't bothered about it, but it is a bit sad that you get this type of harassment or people moaning at you, because it's just an opinion. And until Bigfoot is actually found, it could absolutely, like you say, it could be anything. And I think that Mothman and Jersey Devil has proven that we can have things that exist for a while that clearly are a sum of many parts. But I think with some things, we have got to be more grounded and say, okay, we have got these prints of Bigfoot, and people like Dr. Jeff Meldrum seems to be investigating this sort of thing. I've seen numerous documentaries regarding the Patterson film, and they have said 100% that it's real. And they've proven that with saying it can't anatomically be a hoax. So if it's not a man in a suit, then it's got to be real, because they didn't have those type of effects back then. So it does become a bit all heavy going sometimes, and I think you're always going to get detractors and people having a go at you. I get a lot of that in the UK with the Bigfoot and the big cat sort of stuff, and then they think I'm mad because I like to write about folklore and monsters, but I'm not. You have to keep stuff separate sometimes, so I think that you're always going to get friction in the community.
Right, exactly, yeah. Now, a lot of these stories are, as we said, kind of like folkloric stuff, and but on occasion I do kind of hear these tales of what could best be described as like zoo forms tormenting, usually like countries in Africa or Asia or something like that in modern times. But do you see these sort of things happening in the modern times? Do you think that they would happen more often, given how, you know, we have like, we're living in this Twitter, Facebook world where people can become overwhelmed, you know, a craze can happen overnight. But you don't really see that really, as far as I can tell, in America and in the UK. I guess maybe that whole thing with all the birds that were dying last year kind of may have become something like that. But what do you think of that whole thing?
Yeah, but again,
sometimes?
Well, I think maybe Twitter and Facebook is a double-edged sword. I think with them, they're also restrictive as well, because people are becoming so obsessed with Facebook and Twitter that they're refusing to have an open mind as well. So I know people that only read, you know, we have newspapers in the UK that are atrocious, and people read them and they will come up to me and say, oh, have you read this in the paper? It must be true. It's in the paper. Now, we know the power of newspapers that, you know, they completely lie most of the time and exaggerate. But Twitter and Facebook is easy to spread a rumor. But I think that there are certain crazes which catch on. The more recent one we had was in India a few years ago, which they called the Monkey Man. And it was this kind of 5 to 6 foot tall, hairy type of critter that at night was allegedly coming into people's apartments in parts of Delhi, baking hot, so sweltering hot there to sort of keep their doors open. This thing was coming in and scratching their skull, biting their skull. But they never found it. Some people started saying it resembled like a man that mixed with like a monkey. Other people said it had like a computerized dashboard on its chest. And then gradually it just faded out. And I believe it was a panic. A lot of it was to do with also as well the rhesus monkeys. The rhesus monkey is like a worshipped animal in Delhi. So people couldn't go out and kill this monkey. But I think that you get these weird panics, and it did remind me a lot of a classic London story going back to the 1800s, which a lot of people in the United States would have heard of, called Spring Hill Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a similar type of thing. So I think again, you know, Mothman, are all these things the same? I think they are. I think they are all mostly the result of panic and hysteria, because you can tell somebody a story to try and cause panic, and it may only last a day. But why is it other stories can last anywhere between 5 days or 10, 20 years? So panics can always last. That's the power of urban legends, I guess. Urban legends are passed down over the years, but we try to mold them into whatever the climate is at the time, basically.
Right. And you can kind of go back to the witch trials here in America.
Exactly.
Like an idea.
Yep. Exactly. Like, even with Men in Black, you know, we can't really have Men in Black anymore because they wouldn't fit into our psyche. crop circles in the UK are fading out. You know, you've got the cattle mutilations in the United States. I'm not saying that the cattle mutilations aren't real. They clearly are. But straight away, we think it's aliens. And other people start saying it's these black helicopters. Other people say, well, it must be a predator. Is it a monster? So there's waves and panics. And you do wonder sometimes, why don't we ever get any updates? How long, you know, I'm pretty sure the cattle mutilations are still going on. But they have their time. And then they fade away, and then we move on to the next mystery. And I find that absolutely amazing. Far more amazing than the fact that we could have actual monsters out there.
Well, right, and if you took, like, all the, you know, if you took all the creatures in the A to Z of zoo form phenomena, like, we'd live in a really crazy world. Like, there would be, you know, you couldn't turn around without running into some kind of weird animal.
Yeah, and, you know, you do, because you think to yourself, you know, there's lots of amazing animals on this earth, but, you know, there's creatures I've got in the book, and people have looked at the book and said, that's ridiculous. And I said, yeah. I've said, I'm not saying these animals exist, these things exist, but somewhere, perhaps somebody has seen one of these things or believe this exists, and it's become a legend. Some are very vague. Some, like I say, like Mothman, seem to have a little bit more strength. But it goes right back to sort of the beginning of mankind, and I'm thinking, have these things grown with us as we've grown? And that's why I still think UFOs are part of the same thing. I just think they are. We need them to exist, because we say, yes, we've seen, they look metal. But then again, some creatures to some people look real. Some ghosts to some people look real, but they're not real. Now, I've known people that have seen ghosts that say, well, it was solid. But even that person said, but then it walked through the wall. So ghosts aren't just, you know, frilly white sheets that are semi-transparent. But people are seeing a solid thing, or seemingly solid thing, but it's clearly not a flesh and blood thing. But it doesn't make it kind of not real. So it does become very confusing and a bit surreal and psychedelic when you're putting all these creatures together, like this bizarre menagerie of sort of impossibilities. But, you know, they seem to be out there and all over the place, these monsters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, every country's got its own personal menagerie of weird monsters. Mm. It's very easy.
But they don't seem any different. Like, you know, right. We used to, when you're a kid growing up, you have stories of gargoyles and, like I said, harpies and satyrs and centaurs. People still see these things, but we give them, like I say, different names nowadays. So we wouldn't say, oh, I've seen a gargoyle now. We would say we've seen whatever resembles a gargoyle. We would say it's a Mothman or something like that. So, you know, the Jersey Devil, to me, always sounded like it was something akin to a dragon. And now you look at reports of the Jersey Devil, the last 100 years, it sounds to me very similar to the Chupacabra. It's this little thing with these small wings. So I think that there's so many connections, but they vary regarding or depending on the culture they belong to, if that makes sense.
Right, right, right. Well, like that kind of ties into another idea, too. This, you know, depending on the culture, people ascribe these things to, like, sort of demonic entities. Now, do you give any credence to the idea that there's, like, sort of these sinister entities beyond what may be being created by the mind?
Well, there's got to be good and evil, as they say. I personally, myself, I don't believe in God. I think that God is, to me anyway, in my opinion, before I upset anybody, is a thing that, again, has been put there. It's a faith. I don't believe in sort of the Bible and things like that, but I think if you can have all these zoo formal things, then they can clearly just simply be a god as well, because I see them all as the same sort of thing. But I don't know about a negative energy can certainly spawn something that looks quite hideous. They often say that when you, I think I mentioned at the beginning of my monster book, there's a quote which says about the basic demon as depicted obviously cannot be the being that attracts a traveller. So in other words, it can't, it's almost about luring people, it's shape-shifting. So it's got to appear as a lure, because it's become so kind of heavy going and complicated, but it kind of says here in the Field Guide to Demons that some say the non-corporeal spirits hide within natural shapes. Others claim they never actually actualise by shape-shifting, but simply project illusory images like film stars designed to ensnare and seduce, which kind of goes back to absolutely everything. It's something to lure us in. So it appears sinister, probably because it needs to appear sinister, or it's down to the individual that sees it. It's a bit of a screws with your mind, I think, after this. I've researched some stuff in the past, and it has almost driven me absolutely mad, and I've actually seen some weird things because of the research I've done.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. You can't just tease me. You can't tease me, Neil, with that kind of stuff. What almost drove you mad?
Well, when you start looking into stuff, I think there's certain types of researchers. I think some researchers are able to do research and somehow separate themselves from it. A few years ago, I was basically doing a normal day job, but I've always been a writer since I was little, and I gave up my day job to pursue this full time, as I said, doing the big cat stuff. But doing the monster stuff, the zoo form stuff, you start seeing things which aren't there. I believe that ghost hunters expect to see things. They go out, they see things as a product of their mind. They don't understand that. I've had ghost hunters moan at me because I've said that what they've seen is a projection of their energy and their belief.
Right.
But when you start going into really deep stuff, some people call it psychic backlash. Jonathan Downs once told me to be very, very careful when I was investigating stuff that was becoming quite dark and seemingly sinister. It can almost sort of come back and sort of bite you on the butt, as they say. But it was a bit kind of odd. I basically had weird things kind of happening at night. I don't take drugs. I'm not a big drinker. But when you're writing a lot, you become isolated. Now, like I say, lots of researchers can write stuff and leave it. But I go out in the woods a lot. I spend a lot of time out on my own. I've spoken to a lot of strange people. I attract a lot of strange people as well. It's okay if they're women, but it's the guys that tend to be a bit weird. But yeah, you do. You end up in places that, I'm not saying they're negative, but it's what it feeds. And I've had stuff happen in the night, which I can't explain. And I would class it as almost what we call a psychic vampirism, brought on by stress, lack of sleep. But I can't explain it. I've had doctors and scientists. So many people basically across the world can be laying there at night and they see something in their room, and a doctor could tell them, well, you was eating too much cheese, or it's a nightmare. But some things can't be explained. I don't see why stress would make me lay there at night and make something come into my room and just say, attack me. A bit like in the old Hollywood movie, The Entity, in the 70s.
Yeah.
I think, again, it depends on the individual. I don't get no stuff happen to me now, but I've had stuff in the past, and it was around the time when I was writing the monster book, and it was just very, very creepy stuff that I wouldn't really want to go back to, and on one occasion it actually involved my wife as well. So
weird.
There is stuff that does happen, and I think this is stuff that goes right back. And I, you know, people could say, oh, well, he's probably just mad, but this happens to people all over the world, and I don't know what it is, but I think you've got to be of a certain mindset for it to happen.
Right. And there's, you know, people can accidentally sort of stumble into that kind of thing, you know. There's always that sort of...
I guess, yeah, I think a lot of these things are unintentional. I think that they're often, you can go out looking for stuff, but you won't find it. Sometimes it usually sort of appears when you least expect it, whether it's a ghost or a monster or whatever. But it goes back to that thing again. Do these things appear when there's no one there to see it? And I think the answer is no. So it needs somebody to trigger it off.
Right. And I'm getting thoughts in my mind here of like stories of, you know, this is completely down a different path, but I think kind of related. We're talking about sort of, I coined this term when I talked to Nick about the tulpas, sort of this tulpification, you know, this creation via the mind, you know. And then I think about these stories about people playing with Ouija boards and how, you know, they've been, you know, pre-warned not to do it. And the next thing, and then you hear the stories later that something followed them home and, you know, but really it could just all be a manifestation of what, you know, they were led to expect when they played with the thing in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it all goes back to the kind of the old Victorian seances and table tipping and that thing sort of thing. There were a lot of hoaxes around, but there was a lot of people as well that were kind of sort of seeing things that were probably there, and it was probably the stuff that was sort of what we call psychic energy, negative energy, stuff like that. And of course now we've got the recent panic of the like Hollywood film, The Paranormal Activity.
Yeah.
I think it's an awful film. It's absolute rubbish. But of course, it gets people into it. It's entertainment. And then people start kind of having it happen to them. But that's basically, to me, Paranormal Activity is very similar to Alien Abduction and Hag Attacks. But of course, it's been made into a cultural sort of Hollywood phenomenon, so it becomes more acceptable then.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what we're going to expect next.
Yeah, it does. It comes in trends. And a lot of this was all started off by Blair Witch. Now, I thought the Blair Witch film was quite good, simply because it was nice to see a film that didn't rely on gore, really irritating sort of actors, and a really sort of terrible soundtrack. It just kind of put people out there in the woods, and you made up your own mind. And it was kind of suggestive. With Blair Witch, it was kind of, is it a serial killer? Is it a ghost? Is it satanic? Is it Bigfoot? Is it the Jersey Devil? You didn't know. So Blair Witch was your own personal bogeyman. And I think the bogeyman is something that we've all got, and it always takes different forms, whether it's in the form of, you know, the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, that sort of thing. It's on, the bogeyman appears wherever you want him to.
Now, I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I take it now that, now correct me if I'm wrong, do you give much credence to the idea of ghosts, or are you kind of skeptical about that?
I think a similar thing. I think that people see what they want to see, or you know, they can unintentionally see something. You know, I've got people in my family who I trust with my life that claim to have seen what we call ghosts. So I can't dismiss it, but I've never seen anything. I think loads of people do, but also again, it's to do with a mindset. I think some people are more susceptible, or we could call them psychic. Certainly children and animals seem to be able to pick up certain things. So I'm not going to dismiss people that say they have seen something, but I do think, again, it depends on the individual.
Because, like, that was kind of the setup, because then the other part is just that when you look at, you know, looking at all the different books you've written, you look at the sheer litany of sort of like phantom animals, and how it seems like every animal has a corresponding phantom version. You almost wonder if ghosts are real, then maybe there's ghost animals, and that's what's going on with that whole thing.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I often do ask the question, though, why don't we ever see ghosts of dinosaurs?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it because their energy is too old, or because they were before the mindset of man? So if it's before the mindset of man, I just think that, I don't know, yeah, you do get, I've got reports in the Mystery Animals of the British Isles London book, I've got reports in there of a phantom lion that was seen, a phantom chicken, which was quite funny, the poultrygeist, which I thought was great, phantom birds, phantom bears we've got in London as well. So, yeah, you can certainly have phantom animals, but then the problem is then, is a phantom animal a zoo form? So that's what I had to try and work out when I was kind of doing the book, why to kind of keep it separate. You know, just a bear that had died many years ago but was still being seen. You know, is that the same as a big demonic bear that's kind of 15 foot tall kind of thing? So it's very, very difficult to try and, you know, classify and separate things.
It's such a strange avenue, really. It's really...
It's opening a can of worms, that's the problem. You end up looking into something and you can just go forever and forever, and at some point you have to draw the line and stop.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. But it's commendable, like I said earlier. I mean, this whole idea of the zoo form is really adds an element that the paranormal needs, in a sense.
Yeah, definitely, because I think I was reading magazines as a kid, and there was often you get all the ghost magazines that would come out, and they would always have like... I kept thinking, why don't ghost investigators really go out looking for ghostly animals? You might get reports of, you know, a phantom bird or a phantom domestic cat. But I've got a report going back to, there's a place in London called Hampstead, and it's mentioned there's an old author called Elliot O'Donnell, who was a great author. And he wrote about a chap that went to Sumatra on an expedition, and he was cursed by a local woman. Now, the bizarre thing is, when he came back to London, he started seeing a huge phantom ape in his bedroom. Now, this I would class as a zoo form, because, of course, there's no reason for it to be a ghostly ape, because why would he see a ghost of an ape in his bedroom unless somebody centuries or goodness knows how long ago had a phantom ape? Because we don't have apes in the UK. So that's where it would become a zoo form. But it does go show again how, you know, you say you can have phantom gorillas and phantom this and phantom that, so... Maybe, again, still depends on the individual who sees it, but I don't know why this guy would see a phantom sort of ape unless it was to do with the curse that was put upon him.
Right, right. And you can't really, you know, you almost have to discount the interdimensional idea unless there's, like, corresponding, and you know, all species have their own, you know, interdimensional correspondences, which sounds almost unbelievable in and of itself.
Yeah, because then that means you can have like a phantom ant. But how would you know if it was a phantom ant unless you picked it up and it kind of dissolved? How many phantom ants are there, you know? I tried to do an article once on phantom insects, and there are reports, but they're obviously not as popular as phantom birds and phantom cats and things like that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, you know. When you think about it, up until, like, you know, I don't know the precise date, but maybe, like, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, like, they didn't even know that, like, germs existed.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly.
There could be, like, this whole other realm of things that we don't know about, you know. Maybe that's so these
maybe,
things,
maybe a lot of these things are actually here with us, but, you know, our reality, without sort of going too deep again, but, our, you know, what we class as reality may sort of not be. People have often given the opinion that UFOs come from where we are, similar to ghosts, they kind of flip through some type of tear in the fabric of time.
Yeah.
And maybe they do. Maybe that is what happens. But, of course, we then say, well, it's all in our mind and things like that, and scientists come out and say that's impossible. But people do see these things. So, and people are always going to see these sort of things.
Yeah, yeah. It's just we don't know what the next incarnation of this is going to be.
No. And, of course, in different parts of the world, again, you're getting different social panics, you know. We've had a report in London, near London, only about 3 weeks ago, of what people said was Spring Hill Jack. Now, Spring Hill Jack was around in 1838, and they're saying he's been seen again, although what was seen wasn't the same as Spring Hill Jack, but people are now trying to bring it back to life. But, of course, it's died a death. It's died on its feet because Spring Hill Jack, the legend has already been about. If somebody's seen Mothman nowadays, it's not going to have the same effect as when it was seen in the 1960s because it's gone. The moment has gone for that type of that mystery. The fad is no longer there.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting. I think it's an under-examined sort of aspect of the paranormal, you know. I could have sworn I talked to somebody on the show about this, but I may be wrong. But, you know, I would love to see if there, you know, has ever been sort of like a sort of faux panic, you know, an orchestrated panic of something that was, you know, fake in the first place that turned out to be real. The more I say that now, I'm sure that I've had someone on the show tell me that, but I don't recall.
I think there has been. I think that there's, in the Shadows in the Sky book I've done, apparently there was, we had sightings going back to one of the world wars regarding what we called an angel. It was called the Angel of Mons. It was said to have appeared on the clouds just before war ceased. And everybody kind of in Britain was like, oh, it was amazing to see this thing. Now, my great-grandmother, she actually did see this angel appear in the clouds. Now, bizarrely, a German officer came forward to say that it had actually been projected onto the clouds by the Germans, because they had far better technology than us back then, as a way of making us panic. But, of course, it backfired, and the British troops see it as a sign to sort of urge them on. And, of course, we then conquered the Germans. So that was a panic that was certainly a manufactured-style panic. And I think there's been quite a few manufactured-style panics, if you ask me.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, look at, like, War of the Worlds.
Exactly. I think that if you get it out there again enough, that it can certainly start to happen. If you can instill that type of fear, we had similar things in the UK with, like, Quatermass, which is another quite creepy sort of film.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, yeah, definitely you can put that sort of thing out there. I actually think that another manufactured kind of panic was Roswell. And I would go along possibly with Nick Redfern again, in that I don't think it had anything to do with aliens, but I think that the US government were very happy for aliens to be blamed, because I think that it was something a little bit more sinister and down to earth that was going on there.
Right, right, yeah. Well, that's a popular sort of theory in the UFO community in general, that, you know, the government uses aliens for all sorts of things, like kind of how we said the paranormal uses aliens for scapegoats.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. But then it makes it a little bit more worrying then, though, because then you start thinking, so what are they covering up originally then?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, we talked about how, you know, there's this long history of, like, the dragon and how, you know, it couldn't really exist and that kind of thing. Now, this may be like the most moronic question I've ever asked on the program, but what about the unicorn? Do you think that was something that may have been around a long time ago, died out, or is that something that really is
folklore? That wouldn't be that bizarre. That wouldn't be bizarre, right. Because they've found sort of certain species of deer that have got a central horn almost as a freak. Even some people across the other side of the world have sort of had weird fungal type of horns. So it probably wouldn't be that much of a bizarre thing. You know, I would say that maybe originally there may have been some type of a horse that had some type of freak horn. But then again, the unicorn, a bit like the mermaid, has become a classic sort of folkloric type of creature. But I've certainly seen far more exaggerated cases of weird creatures than the unicorn. I think that even if it was a completely fabricated thing, they maybe could have used their imagination a little bit more, maybe given it, like they did with Pegasus, giving it wings or something. Because, like I say, just having a horn on a creature is not that bizarre, if you ask me. So maybe there is a possibility there was once, you know, a creature with that type of sort of thing on its head. Who knows?
Right, right. Well, it kind of goes back to what I was thinking when we were talking about, you know, zooforms versus cryptids, where it's like, the stuff that we're saying might be cryptids, like the Tasmanian tiger. I mean, that's really, you know, it'd be awesome if they captured it, and it would be great and everything, but at the same time, it's really just, it's really not that exotic in a way. Do you know what I mean?
No.
So, and you know, there's stories all the time about how they're discovering, like, new species of deer and stuff like that. So it's like, almost like a good rule of thumb is it's like, if the creature is similar to a regular creature, then it's, you know, maybe more likely to be a cryptid than a zooform. But if we're talking about, you know, some amalgamation of a man and an animal, then it's more likely a zooform of some kind.
Definitely, yeah, and that's what, again, is quite frustrating when it's put under cryptozoology. You know, you've got, there are several reports all over, the world of differing sort of creatures. But, you know, the Jersey Devil I find interesting because some people believe it was like, it could be like what we call the hammer-headed bat, which is a real creature with a very bizarre-looking sort of long head. And some people describe this, but other people say, we've heard weird screaming in the Pine Barrens, it's the Jersey Devil. Well, to me, that would sound like it would be a cougar. Then other people can say, well, it was a dragon, it had leathery sort of wings and stuff like that. Other people believe it was a folkloric demon, of course, that was connected to a mother Leeds going back centuries ago, and she had sort of the 13th child was cast off from the family and took to the sky. So it becomes folklore anyway, but of course people still claim to see the Jersey Devil, but it's just a sum of many parts. The credit I will give to the Jersey Devil is that it seems to have outlasted more, you know, sort of most other zooforms, in the sense I think it was first seen around sort of a few hundred years ago, with most things seem to be social panics for a very short amount of time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that, you know, maybe that goes back to what we sort of were talking about earlier, about how America has a shorter history, in a sense. That's why maybe the Mothman and the Jersey Devil have taken hold, because we need our own native monsters.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. But I think, again, we have a need for monsters, but I do love the idea that we're unintentionally putting energy out there and creating things that are almost chimera, sort of disfigured beasts. And it is down to your own interpretation. The classic experiment is if you can try, if you get a group of people together and you all try and sit there for probably an hour a night for goodness knows how long, maybe a year or so, and all try and picture something like a black dog, you will all still have your own interpretations of that dog. So when it appears, it will either appear completely bizarre as a hybrid of all your conjurations, or it will appear to each of you differently. So that is, I think, how these things are coming about. Now, I've got a good friend, Richard Freeman, who is part of the CFZ, and he wrote a great book a few years ago called Dragons, More Than a Myth. And he's also been to places like Sumatra looking for the Orang Pendek.
Mm-hmm.
But many years ago, when he was a student, he managed to raise a bizarre spectral zooform spider. And he did this with a series of kind of conjurations at night, trying to think of this concentrated type of creature. And bizarrely, when he eventually saw it, he said it was almost like a flat sort of cardboard type of sort of weird spider that kind of went up the stairs, but it was big. Now, I think you can actually conjure things, but I think you can also conjure things unintentionally as well as intentionally. So almost devil worship can conjure things because it's concentrated, other things, of course, poltergeist activity are spawned spontaneously to an extent.
Right, right. Well, the devil worship stuff, that opens up a whole other door of, like, black magic and you know, that kind of frightening sort of stuff. Where
and it's interesting that we used to have a black magician named Aleister Crowley that used to live on the banks of Loch Ness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but I know the first ever reports of the Loch Ness Monster go back to sort of 565 AD, when St. Columba apparently drove a creature back into the loch when it was attacking somebody in the water. Now, for me, that could have been a catfish, that could have been a large pike. But it's interesting that, again, people then started seeing the long neck thing and now it's a black hump. So really, there's no consistency. But who knows, maybe the Loch Ness Monster is a tulpa as well. But if you start telling that to people, they'll start slagging you off because they're saying, well, I've seen it, I know what I saw was real. But then how do we define real in that sense?
I would like to see more studies done on this tulpa phenomenon. I wish that,
definitely.
You know, I don't know why, you know, with all the science out there, I don't know why we haven't seen a serious sort of chance to look at this. I don't even know what you would call it, really, a phenomenon or what. But it would be interesting to see an organized attempt in the modern age to do this sort of research.
Well, I think I often call these things social constructs, as in another weird panic, which Lauren Coleman spoke about, and is quite popular in the United States, is the phantom clowns. Now, it's quite odd how there's several panics about phantom clowns. Now, phantom clowns, of course, or clowns in any sense, tend to terrify people.
Right.
I think clowns are amazing, but most people find them quite freaky. And yet, there has been cases where so-called people have been attacked or harassed by clowns. Now, I find it odd that it's a little bit, it's a Chinese whisper, it's an urban legend. I remember when I used to go to school, we used to have legends of what were called the Chelsea Smilers. And we was told that a group of so-called football or soccer hooligans would be hanging around the school after school time had finished, and they would be waiting for us kids to go out. And what they would do, they would be slashing us across the mouth with their razors.
Oh, God.
And then they would knee you in the groin to make you scream and split your mouth. But these people didn't exist. But it's panic.
That's terrifying.
A bit like the mad gasser of Mattoon in Illinois. People were saying they was being gassed. We've got another one called the Halifax Slasher in the 70s in Yorkshire, in England. People said they were being attacked by a razor-wielding maniac. Is it any different to Spring Hill Jack? I don't think it is. Is it anything different to phantom clowns? No. They don't exist, but they become a syndrome. They become a panic. And the more you believe in it, it starts to happen. Bunny Man was another one. You've got the Bunny Man Bridge in the United States, in Fairfax, Virginia, I believe it is. And there's this legend that there's this, it's either a giant rabbit or it's a man covered in bizarre animal skins. And, of course, this story over years has been passed down by teenagers around roaring campfires. They go out at night and get a bit drunk. And they say if you don't behave, the Bunny Man will come and get you. So it's a local boogeyman. But interestingly, sort of going back to sort of the 1970s, I believe, there was actually a man dressed up in a bunny suit running around the sort of the backwoods chasing people, telling them to get off his land. So some of these things do spawn from actual facts.
Right, right. Starts out where it's like one isolated incident and the story kind of gets passed down along. And
But the boogeyman is always there, you know. You know, Santa Claus is a boogeyman. If you don't behave at Christmas, he won't bring you any presents. The tooth fairy, you leave a tooth under your pillow and the tooth fairy comes in your bedroom of a night, leaves you a penny or whatever and takes your tooth away. We've got the Sandman. The Sandman comes at night and he sprinkles sand in your eyes. Are they any different to Goatman and Mothman?
That's the question, yeah. That's the, you know, that's...
And Santa Claus has probably got to be the biggest, if he was, I'm not saying he's a zoo form, but Santa Claus doesn't exist, and look how he's become such an icon. We all know what Santa Claus looks like, but he doesn't exist. Santa Claus is like the human version of the dragon.
That's true, and believe it or not, there are people who say that they have seen Santa Claus. It's not, you know...
Exactly.
It's not, exactly. You know, this isn't outside the realm, you know, I'm not making that up, folks. I mean,
yeah,
there are stories of Santa Claus sightings. So it really...
And it's proof of how something embeds itself into the local subconscious and it becomes reality, or it becomes an icon that exists forever. And you, like the dragon, if it doesn't exist, then where the hell did it come from? Why does it exist forever?
Like Elvis.
Yeah.
Now, as I said, you got the book coming out on May 1st. That's what Amazon tells me. May 1st, 2012, Shadows in the Sky, The Haunted Airways of Britain. What else are you working on? What's it like being a full-time monster hunter? Like, what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, apart from writing, and I give lectures, I go out and do lots of group talks to everything from children to sort of, you know, certain specialist groups, wildlife groups, everything. But I also, it can be quite isolating when you're a writer because you're involved in this sort of stuff all the time. I find it very difficult to find a middle ground. So, you know, when I was younger, I could write and then do something else. Although I've got interests heavily into sort of, I'm into music and stuff like that, I find it, writing is very consuming. And when it's, you're constantly writing about this sort of stuff, it leads you into some very strange places. But I also spend a lot of time out in the woods as well, regarding the big cat research. I was out last Saturday evening. I was out with a friend, and we was looking for a black leopard that's been seen locally. I've actually seen a black leopard 3 times in the UK, and that's quite eerie because you're going to places that are generally eerie anyway.
Yeah.
And the fact that you could have a big black leopard sitting there looking at you and you wouldn't even know it also makes it a bit odd. But it's great going to places and interviewing witnesses and telling people about what you do as well. So it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you get a lot of calls from people who want to share their story? I'm sure that probably happens a lot.
Oh, yeah, and you get lots of lunatics ringing up as well. It's sort of 4 o'clock in the morning, but you have to sort of take the rough with the smooth. But it's great. You do, you know, I've become great friends with people. I've worked with the police, wildlife authorities, biologists, zoologists. So the big cat stuff is really interesting. But it is interesting when you do get somebody see something very, very weird. And I've had a few reports, which is quite odd, of a so-called, what we class as a Bigfoot type of thing in local woods. And that's been seen about 6 or 7 times. And I can't understand that. And these are people that are very genuine. I've become very good friends with some of these. I've known a lady that actually crashed her car to avoid this figure that ran across the road. So there's got to be something in it. So they're the sort of phone calls that get a little bit, you know, quite exciting, but they're quite eerie as well.
What kind of lunatics are calling you at 4 in the morning? I would lose it.
People, some people just do sort of, yeah, prank calls you sometimes get. Other people actually do genuinely see, they may have seen a big black leopard and they ring you up at 5 o'clock in the morning thinking you're going to be awake. They think because you're a monster hunter, you don't go to sleep. And they think you're out in the woods all the time. But of course you get people that are genuinely ring up. Some people genuinely ring up and they've just had a misinterpretation. They may have seen a domestic cat they thought was a leopard because, however intelligent people think they are, there's lots of people who actually don't understand even about natural history. Some people have never even seen a badger or a deer in the woods. So that's what annoys me when you get skeptics kind of saying there's no big cats around. And I ask them if they've ever seen a deer and they say no. And yet we've got thousands of deer in the UK, so it kind of puts it into perspective.
Right, exactly. Having talked to you and having looked at the big cat phenomenon and having talked to Nick at length about it too, it's like, it seems like a pretty open and shut case that these are real large cats that, you know, have escaped over time and sort of created their own little population. Do you foresee a time when, you know, that mindset will be just accepted by the mainstream? I'm surprised that there's, like, skeptics of this. Like I asked earlier why the media hasn't really got on board with that interpretation. It seemed like that
the media only wants sensationalism. But there are a few people out there that have tried to do more. The problem is, at the moment, we're getting reports. Every county's kind of got the beast of this and the beast of that.
Yeah.
Recently, we had a bit of blurry footage of a black animal running across the field. And one researcher said it was the best evidence ever. Well, it's complete rubbish. It's terrible evidence because even in today's technology, when you go out walking, you don't expect to see a leopard. So it's difficult to get clear footage. I've got some good photographs, but the best evidence for me is when we find sheep and deer dragged up 30 feet in a tree and completely eaten. A leopard only kills in a certain manner, often with a throat bite. Rasps all the fleece and fur away. Also, we've got scat. We've got paw prints, you know, we've got scat, leopard scat. You can tell it's leopard scat. It's sort of 9 inches long. Apart from a dog, in the UK, we don't have wolves. We don't have coyotes. We've got, you know, rats, mice, squirrels, sheep, deer, badgers, foxes. So there's nothing like leopard scat in the UK. So when we find it, we want it, you know, it'd be nice if it could get analysed, but it takes a long time. And if it does get analysed, nothing ever comes of it. You could say this is proven to be leopard scat, and you could show it to somebody, And even if a scientist says, yes, that's leopard scat, the newspaper could just say, well, it could just be one animal that's escaped from somewhere.
Right, right.
Exactly. And that's the problem we've got, is that people are a little bit ignorant. They don't realise that these animals have been seen a long time, and there's a science to this, there's a biology. You know, you can't... In the UK, we only have sightings of black leopards. We don't really have sightings of what we class as normal leopards with the straw-coloured coat. And that's because of the recessive gene. You know, black parents only produce black offspring. Occasionally, we have black squirrels in the UK, but it's very rare. But in the leopard, it's a stronger gene. We don't have... People keep talking about hybrids of leopards and puma. There's no evidence to suggest that. It doesn't happen in the wild. We have these weird crossbreedings in zoos, but they're freaks. So there's got to be enough black leopard, puma and lynx, otherwise they would die out. These cats only live until they're about 13, 14 in the wild. So an animal seen in 1965 would be riddled with arthritis now and probably have a very long beard.
Yeah.
So it's just not the same animal, and that's what people have got to realise. There's more to this than meets the eye.
So what do you think the population of these big cats might be then?
Well, there's certainly, you know, one leopard can have a territory of sort of 200 to 300 square mile. But finding that a male leopard can have a territory in the UK of probably 30, 40 square mile, and he could have maybe two females within that. We get reports of cubs. So there's not hundreds of these animals around, but there's certainly each county's got small pockets. But, of course, somewhere like Dartmoor or Bodmin or Exmoor, that's vast. And, of course, a cat can easily cross county. So... But we're not going to have a case of just, say, a black leopard in Texas then running to the other end of the United States to breed. So there's got to be enough in each area, because you're not just talking about one female on heat doing the rounds all around the United States or all around the UK.
Right.
It's just not viable. So, yeah, there's no mystery to the big cats at all, but sadly, of course, people kind of deep down want it to be a mystery, and all the time the government or whoever don't officially accept them, they will always be folklore. But they will never be accepted, because it will be down, of course, then to money, because the government will probably want these animals eradicated.
Right, right. Well, that's to tie back to the zoo form stuff. That's the kind of idea, in a way, that that frightens me as a paranormal enthusiast, I guess you could say. If like, all of this stuff is a product of the mind, except for, like, Bigfoot, the Orang, Pendek, and some of these other animals, I'd be kind of disappointed, in a way. You know, I kind of hope that there are UFOs, you know? I can live without werewolves and vampires, but... You know, it's...
But your hope will obviously keep you going anyway. So you'll probably never find out whether there are UFOs. Well, you know, my opinions is probably not as valid as anybody else's. But I just think we've got to look deeper and always go by consistency. I think that people say to me, you know, I've been abducted by aliens. Fair enough. But if you also look at the hag style of attack as well, it still goes again with the mindset, and it moves with the time. So... I don't know. Maybe we just so desperately want there to be UFOs in the sense of aliens. But I just don't think there are.
Yeah, I think it comes from a place of, like, wanting to escape the planet or something.
Yeah, that's our need for monsters, isn't it? We've got these vast jungles in the world. We still so desperately want there to be undiscovered species. So we want there to be a monster in Loch Ness. But, you know, you've got to also look at it and say, well, can there biologically be a plesiosaur? No. But, of course, people want there to be, because it kind of, it's a little inkling that, oh, what if there is still a dinosaur out there somewhere? If there's a dinosaur still out there, then that's more ridiculous, I believe. It's almost laughable that there could be a living dinosaur in Scotland. It doesn't make sense at all.
Right, right. Well, go ahead.
And then, of course, then to me, that makes UFOs seem even more ridiculous.
Well, what you touched on speaks to, like, what might be seen as like a larger cultural crisis, if you will, that in these modern times with the spread of communication, you know how they say the world's getting smaller, and it's like maybe there's part of us that wants there to be unknowns, that needs the unknowns, and you know, as we're reaching this age where it seems like everything is known, it creates this you know, internal conflict inside of the, you know, the whole species.
Definitely. Well, when I write books, when I wrote Mystery Animals of London and I wrote Monster, I still write. I take a lot of inspiration from my childhood. I grew up with some very bizarre... I was interested in the Banana Splits program, and it was all weird psychedelic stuff, and I love all that. We're losing that. I'd hate to think what the world's going to be like in maybe 300 years, because we're building and developing so much that it's not going to be able to hold us anymore. So we have to keep looking to the dark corners, dark rivers, and the skies, hoping that there's something else.
Yeah.
But of course, we've got a fear of the unknown as well. So if something does come from the unknown, so if we do find Bigfoot, and Bigfoot is an unknown species of upright walking ape, or a form of man, it's going to turn science on its head.
Yeah.
It really is. So if we find that UFOs are actually driven by aliens...
Oh, forget about it, yeah.
...that come from another planet, then that's amazing, and it's also going to turn science on its head. Then there's the other worry is, like some people believe, that aliens are already here, and they're in cohorts with our government. Well, that's another also complete mind screw-up, if you ask me. If there is no UFOs, then the government could also be to blame, which is another mind screw-up. Are they projecting these things? If not, what if it's just to do with the mind in a sense and we don't understand our own minds? Well, then it's another big mind screw-up. So we can't win either way, really, so we're all doomed.
Well, I think
if they drain Loch Ness and there's nothing in there, then it kills the mystery, doesn't it?
That's for sure. That's absolutely true.
If we find Bigfoot, it kills the mystery.
That's true. It's the paradox of the paranormal. We want the answer, but to find the answer...
We don't really, do we?
Right. It's very weird, yeah. It's very strange.
So it becomes within us to an extent all the time. It's always within us, you know. And if they find one Bigfoot, will that be enough if they find one? Probably not.
No way.
So it will lead to another mystery to an extent, because Bigfoot is probably not related. You know, they talk about the skunk ape and things like that, and it's interesting with Bigfoot that we've got these all over the world. So I think that I hope there's a Bigfoot. I think for me it would be quite disappointing if there wasn't. And
absolutely,
I really hope deep down, because at the moment we've got so much hanging on that Patterson film. We always will. And yet, sadly, really, the Patterson film is so old now that it shouldn't really be relevant. And yet we're clinging to it until a hunter brings in a dead Bigfoot. And the worrying thing is, if a hunter kills one, I'm pretty sure the government will take it away. And we may hear no more of it, which, in a way, the government have kind of got a right to do. If a UFO crashes, why should the government tell the local UFO investigator? They've got every right to kind of take it away and do what they want to do with it. So it's always just at the edge of sort of our sort of psyche to... We want it to be there, but I don't know if it is. And I don't know if that scares me more.
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable stuff. Well... We said here, Shadows in the Sky coming out this May. What else do you have planned? We kind of talked about your everyday life as a monster hunter, but I'm sure you have a lot of stuff in the works. So
I began writing a book when I was 12 called Cryptozoology in the Movies. Interestingly, I think about a month ago, a book came out called The Bigfoot Filmography. It's quite a lot of money, but it's a guy's written it. I can't remember his name, which is what I thought. He's obviously thought it was quite a good idea, but I've been trying to do a book for 20-odd years now, basically just an A to Z of movies, commercials, cartoons that have featured cryptozoology.
Nice.
The book's pretty much done, but I want to get it with a good publisher, and I'd love to get it with an American publisher. I've never had anything published by an American publisher, but I think there would be a call for this or interest with Americans rather than the British public, because we don't really know anything about cryptozoology. We've kind of got Loch Ness and big cats, and that's about it. We know what Bigfoot is, but to us it's too far away. So I think by doing a book on cryptozoology in the movies would be completely unique, and certainly even kids' cartoons and stuff like that, and Doctor Who, and anything that mentions kind of Bigfoot, Yeti, and that sort of thing. So it's kind of done, but I want to get it published with the right people.
Right, right, exactly. All right, this is the thanks part. Just don't hang up afterwards, okay? Well, amazingly, we've reached the 2-hour mark here, and I've just so thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I think you touched on it just moments ago. You know, just mind-bending stuff, really thought-provoking conversation here. I think one that people are going to want to go back and listen to a couple times around just to sort of wrap their minds around what we've been talking about here. So, I mean, I just can't thank you enough. I've enjoyed this so much. Neil Arnold, of course, the author of Mystery Animals of the British Isles, London, as well as Mystery Animals of the British Isles, Kent, and Monster, the A to Z of Zooform Phenomena, and Paranormal London, and the new one, Shadows in the Sky, the Haunted Airways of Britain. Tremendous conversation, Neil, and I can't wait to have you back on the program for further discussion on the Zooform Phenomena and really what it all means in the big picture of the paranormal.
Well, thanks for having me on. As you can imagine, I'm pretty good company around a roaring campfire, also a local pub as well, because all my friends, we end up getting into these kind of conversations, and it can end up sort of going on all night. So like I say, sometimes you do just need to go away and sort of have something to eat, or maybe just put a film on to kind of to rest your mind. But it's just such an amazing thing to talk about, you know. There's so much weird stuff out there, so everybody loves a mystery.
Absolutely, and thank you once again for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big thanks to Neil Arnold for coming on the show and giving us so much time. If you want more from Neil Arnold, head on out and pick up his books, Monster, the A to Z of Zooform Phenomena, as well as Mystery Animals of the British Isles, Kent, Mystery Animals of the British Isles, London, Paranormal London, and the new book, Shadows in the Sky, The Haunted Airways of Britain. Beyond that, be sure to head on over to his website, zooform.blogspot.com, for more from Neil Arnold. Be sure to check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, and since we are way past the usual deadline for a new edition of BOA Audio, we're going to do 3 really short emails from the listeners. But before I dig into the mailbag, I want to throw in a quick plug here. On September 8th, I'll be heading up to Maine for the Experiencers Speak Conference. And that's going to be headlined by Travis Walton, as well as Peter Robbins and Kathleen Martin. And as I said, that's up in Maine, Gorham, Maine, to be specific, Saturday, September 8th. Beyond those 3 folks, there's going to be a lot of great speakers there as well. So if you're in the New England area and you're looking for a fantastic UFO conference, head on up to Gorham, Maine, for the Experiencers Speak Conference. Only about $20 a ticket, so very, very affordable for the folks who are looking for a fantastic an informative day. That is one you want to go out of your way to check out, and you can find out more about that at experiencersspeak.blogspot.com, or just punch in Experiencers Speak into your Google machine and you will find out a whole wealth of information about the big event in Gorham, Maine on September 8th. Now, let's dive on into the mailbag. We've actually got first a response from Ben, who wrote to us last week offering to put me up in Minnesota and give me a tattoo. Here's what he has to say. I just heard episode 10. Tattooing is my job, so this one would be on me. If you take your cross-country trip, you most definitely have a place to crash and recover at here. Thanks again, buddy. Ben. So there you go, we solved the mystery of whether or not I'd have to pay for that tattoo, and apparently it is on the house, courtesy of Ben. Anyone with a suggestion on a tattoo, send it in to me. I'd be interested in seeing it or hearing about it from the BOA Audio listeners. Next email comes from Laura, no hometown listed. Here's what she has to say. Where's Ann Druffel? You really need her back on. Please make it happen now. I've been asking and waiting very patiently. For quite a while. Love all your shows. But I want Ann Druffel, and she's waiting, because she's told me so. Laura. I should point out that this correspondence actually contains numerous exclamation points and is written nearly entirely in caps, except for the word wares at the very beginning. I don't know if Laura got her caps lock stuck down or if she's just shouting at me. I do recall Laura has written to me before requesting that we get Ann Druffel back on the show, and believe me, I would love to get Ann Druffel back on the show, but there's only so much time in my days and weeks, as many folks can probably figure out, considering it's been 3 weeks since the last edition of the program. But in light of Laura's passionate request, I will definitely try to get Ann Druffel back on the program here in Season 7, because I would love to talk to her again. Loved the Ann Druffel trilogy. For the folks who have not checked that one out, definitely go back and dig into that one. That was the first ever BOA audio trilogy, and it was tremendous. And I'm sure a return from Ann Druffel on BOA audio would be awesome as well. So thank you for writing in, Laura. Thank you for poking me with the caps locked stick and reminding me that the return of Ann Druffel is definitely long overdue on the program. Final email comes from Afghan Bob. I'm sure many folks may remember him. We read his email on the BOA Audio Season 5 finale, I believe. The episode with David Icke. We've done so many shows now, I'm forgetting when we did these seasons. But nonetheless, Afghan Bob, he writes to us. He says, I wrote to you a couple years ago. I'm finishing my fourth and last year here in Afghanistan. Thanks for your great podcast. I've enjoyed listening and learning. My wife and I will be in Boston late September. She has us booked for the Boston Cemetery tour. Any other things of paranormal interest to see? Afghan Bob in Hamilton, Ohio. Thank you, Afghan Bob, once again for writing in. Obviously, thank you so much for your service. 4 years in Afghanistan. That's just tremendous and really, really amazing. So thank you, Afghan Bob, for your service. I would suggest if you're going to be in the New England area for long, there's a number of things you could check out. A short 90-minute drive or so up to Maine to see Lauren Coleman's International Cryptozoology Museum is definitely something I recommend for anybody who has the ability to go out and check that out. And along the way, you could probably, I don't know the exact route, but you may be able to check out some of the Betty and Barney Hill stuff in New Hampshire. If you're in Massachusetts, there's always Salem is rich with a whole bunch of interesting paranormal stuff. And of course, down in southern Massachusetts, you got the Bridgewater Triangle that has a whole bunch of stuff. Although I'm pretty sure there's not really a bustling Bridgewater Triangle tourist community, if you will. So you'd really have to get someone who knows what they're talking about. And I personally would not really be able to help you out because I'm only vaguely familiar with the stories of the Bridgewater Triangle. Nonetheless, folks will be happy to know I wrote to Afghan Bob, not just on my Facebook wall with some of these suggestions, but also to invite him and Mrs. Afghan Bob out to a nice dinner when they're in Boston in September. So hopefully Afghan Bob and Mrs. Afghan Bob and Binal will be dining somewhere in the greater Boston area in late September. Happy to go out to eat with the Bobs, and I'm sure it will be a fun and enjoyable evening. And on that note, we close up the mailbag here for this edition of the program. Big thanks to Ben, Laura, and Afghan Bob for writing in on this edition of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. If you'd like to be a part of future installments of the feedback segment, here's how you can reach out to me. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or head on over to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L ofamerica.com, and click the contact button. Or you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground, the United States of Esoterica. You can find that also by clicking the forum button at Binal of America. Additionally, we are on Facebook and Twitter, so just punch in Binal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and you'll be able to find me there. And of course, you definitely want to like Binal of America on Facebook. That's actually where I got Ben and Laura's postings for this edition of Listener Feedback. So head on over to Facebook, punch in Binal of America, and you'll find us. I think we're close to 800 now. I'd like to get us to 1,000 maybe by the end of the year. So if you have not liked us yet on Facebook, please do so. It would be greatly appreciated. Up next, let's thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Since the last time you heard from me, we got a couple of new pieces up at BOA, an all-new Shadow of the Shinigami by Marla Pena, talking about how she's actually named after a famous Mexican contactee. Fascinating stuff from Marla Pena. And additionally, we've got a new piece from Richard Thomas under his Sci-Fi Worlds banner titled Reflections on Ancient Astronauts in Prometheus. So if you've seen the film Prometheus this summer, you definitely want to check out Richard's Sci-Fi Worlds. Coming soon to BOA, we've got an all-new Trickster's Realm from Regan Lee and certainly a whole bunch more from the BOA staff. We say it week in and week out, my friends, but it is the truth. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, then you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a destination for your paranormal entertainment and enlightenment. Now comes the time in the program where we pass the hat around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the Banal of America franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. There are two ways in which you can make a donation to Banal of America. You can head on over to BOA and click the PayPal button. That's right there on the left-hand side of the homepage. And right underneath that, we've got the snail mail address for folks who don't trust the internet and want to mail in donations. Maybe you're listening to this somehow and you don't have access to the internet, so let me run through the address one time for you here, folks. It is Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you spell Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. As noted, the complete address can be found at Banal of America. And as we've pointed out numerous times here at the end of the show, if you mail us a donation, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, since my bank is anal and they will not cash those donations. And please include some means of correspondence so I can reach out to you and thank you for your donation. As always, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, we have got an absolute barn burner of a program for you, my friends, and I promise it will be coming at you much, much sooner than this one took to get posted. Our guest is Kendall Carver. He's the founder of the advocacy group International Cruise Victims. And as such, we're going to be venturing into some uncharted waters as we learn about the truly troubling trend of disappearances and felonious crimes committed on cruise ships, as well as how they are subsequently covered up by the cruise ship industry. Kendall Carver, sadly, lost his daughter on one of these cruise ships under very, very mysterious and controversial circumstances, and he has made it his crusade to hold the cruise ship industry accountable for the many, many people who are affected by the lawlessness on these trips. There's a really dark underbelly to the cruise ship industry, and that's what we're going to be getting into next time on the program. I've looked around. Kendall Carver has done a lot of mainstream media appearances, but he has never done a program like BOA Audio. He has not ventured into the esoteric realm yet. And oftentimes, when you do see Kendall Carver on these programs, he's only got maybe 30 seconds to 5 minutes at the most to talk. Well, this is a 2-hour conversation with Kendall Carver that is going to be covering tons of stuff, and it will truly freak people out and leave you chilled after you hear this program, my friends. And as I said, we're going to try and get it to you as soon as possible. I'm really hoping to get it to you within a week, so stay tuned to Banal of America for this episode. It will be a can't-miss edition of BOA Audio. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Once again, big, big thanks to Neil Arnold for coming on the show. Thanks to Ben, Laura, and Afghan Bob for joining us in BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the people who put up with the interminable delays between episodes. Folks, this has been a hellacious August. I'm so happy that I'm looking down in the corner of my computer screen and seeing that it is September 1st, because I need a fresh start here, and I'm very, very excited about the summer coming to a close and the fall unfolding, and I'm sure we've got some awesome stuff for the BOA Audio listeners in the weeks and months to come. And I just want to once again thank all you folks out there for your support of the program. I hope all of our fantastic American listeners have an awesome Labor Day, and you'll be hearing from me very, very soon. Thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.